have you with us here on the Ideas Network. We're going to take a look at the wonderful world of Wisconsin outdoors today on the show. Many hunters are getting ready for what will hopefully be a successful gun deer hunt around the state. So we'll talk about the state deer herd today. And of course, we'll deal with all other kinds of wildlife issues as we visit with David Drake and Jamie Neck. David, a professor of forest and wildlife ecology at UW-Madison and UW Extension wildlife specialist. And Jamie Neck is a UW Extension senior wildlife outreach specialist in that same department of forest and wildlife ecology. So are you preparing for the gun deer season? Do you have some questions about critters that may be affecting you as you round your home? I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. David Drake, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Larry. It's always good to be with you.
And Jamie Neck, great to see you again as well.
Thank you. Great to be here. Thanks,
yeah,
Larry.
Thanks for joining us. I tell you what, there are a lot of people here in Wisconsin that are getting ready for the gun deer season, which is only a few weeks away now.
It's that time of year, November 1st today, and the cold temperature certainly has me thinking about it and have already begun doing some preparing. So whether you're out scouting, certainly the rutting activity has definitely picked up. Seen more bucks running around chasing does, more sign in terms of buck rubs, scrapes in the woods. So it's definitely picking up. First week of November is generally the peak of the rut. So in addition to that, folks are checking equipment. It's time to go and sight in your firearm, whether that be a rifle or a shotgun. I know I've been making food for deer camp and putting it in the freezer, so just made a double batch of chili last weekend and got that tucked away. So lots of preparations weeks before the hunting season. But one of the things we really want to remind people about is reviewing the hunting regulations. And there are some changes for the 2017 9-day gun deer season.
Yeah, two or three big changes.
A couple of big changes, and I'll mention this early on and then hopefully again as well, but if you go to the Department of Natural Resources website, that is where you'll find the deer hunting regulations. There's a number of frequently asked question handouts that you can print out that talk about things like baiting and feeding and what the regulations are there, which counties are affected. Also, information on where to get your deer sampled for chronic wasting disease, and that's certainly something we would encourage you to do. And then also the state has tried something new this year, a new approach. Instead of doing the annual deer hunt TV show, they've gone to doing some 7-minute video segments or podcasts that are available under the Wild Wisconsin name. So if you were to keyword search Wild Wisconsin, you'd be able to watch those 7-minute videos. There's also some off-the-record podcasts that are longer segments on habitat or the Deer Management Assistance Program. I think in the quick segments, there's two back-to-back ones on deer processing or processing, you know, how to do the process and handling of your deer.
Dan Small, by the way, is going to be on next week, so
yes,
we'll talk
and
with
he'll,
him.
Yeah. Yep, he'll have a show just as far as what the state agency is doing. They're trying to do some of these podcasts and little shorter segments that you can, you can listen to them in your deer stand if you want to.
There you go.
So a couple of the changes, the important one relates to tagging. So validation and tagging is no longer required, but you still need to carry proof of a hunting license and your deer tags. So things that you could carry to show that proof would be a paper copy of those tags in your license. Or if you did go through the Go Wild system and authenticated your driver's license, that would suffice.
I have a Go Wild card.
And then the Go Wild card. I do too. So the DNR-issued Go Wild conservation card would be a record that your tags and licenses could be validated on. Or on your phone, if you downloaded the PDF or a digital format of that license, you could show your electronic device. So paper carcass tags you may have already received, those are still...
use them if you want.
Yeah, they're still valid. So, I mean, even if you wanted to still punch them out and tag your deer, you're doing more than what is required by law. So it's fine to go ahead and do that. But you're not required to. You are, however, required to register your deer.
Yeah.
So you still need To register your deer by 5 p.m. the day after recovery.
So 24 hours, essentially, yep. You got.
Yep, and so you can do that through the Game Reg section of your Go Wild account. You can do it at a DNR station, licensing station, and then there are also probably still some on local deer registration stations that might also offer sampling for chronic wasting disease as well. So that's the big one. That you don't have to validate and tag your deer any longer. You still need to register it.
You know, Alan Burlington has a question that relates to the deer herd, so maybe just go there and see what's on Al's mind. Al, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yes, thank you, and good morning. I got a question about the general disease in our wild deer population. Of course, we've heard about CWD for years. My cousin ranches in South Dakota, and there was some nasty disease that's taken out a third of the whitetails, and it's something like blue tongue or something that's related to a domestic livestock disease. It has something to do with a fly and small drying ponds of water. Do you know anything about that, and is it possible that it could just come this far east? And thanks, and we like science. We appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you very much for calling, Al. David, do you want to take that?
Al, that's typically caused by a midge, which is a small type of flying insect as well. And that disease is more of an eruptive type disease. So
is it called blue tongue, by the way?
That's one type thing. Zoonotic
hemorrhagic disease.
Disease.
So EHD.
Yeah. EHD, but blue tongue is what it shows up as. And unlike chronic wasting disease, which is a disease that is seemingly now it's a annual chronic disease that we're probably never going to get rid of, the blue tongue or the EHD is more eruptive. So depending on the midge and the environmental conditions for midges and things like that, you'll have these eruptions of the disease. But it's not it doesn't occur every single year in the same location, and it moves around and things like that. So it is certainly a disease that can be a problem. You know, we don't have in Wisconsin brucellosis or TB tuberculosis, but you know, some of the neighboring states have that, and other states in the country. So there are other diseases beyond chronic wasting disease. Although the primary focus is obviously on chronic wasting disease, not only in Wisconsin, but really across most of the states in the country.
And so, Al, that epizootic hemorrhagic disease, we have had incidents of that in the state, and it tends to be very localized, tends to occur late summer when there are more drought-like conditions, so water sources are more concentrated, and then the deer are drinking during, you know, in areas where those midges exist. And then they usually die fairly quickly. So a lot of times it's discovered by finding a number of dead deer on the landscape and then mitigated. It's really a disease not necessarily coming from the West, but in the southern part of the U.S. So more of our southern states see EHD. So it would be a question in terms of climate change. What will we see in the years to come? If you want to learn more about it, you could certainly look on the DNR's website, but also the CDC, the Center for Disease
Control
would have a little fact sheet about that disease.
Just thinking overall, what's the state of our deer herd in Wisconsin right now?
It's generally good, you know. I mean, especially in areas where you have a lot of agricultural component on the landscape, and certainly around urban suburban type areas where you have a lot of food, both natural food sources, but also supplemented food sources, you know, landscaping and things like that. But generally, the deer population is in really good shape.
You can join in too, by the way, with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. Let's go to Aaron in La Crosse next. Hi, Aaron. Thanks for calling.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for taking my call. I had a question about lead ammunition for deer hunting.
Mm-hmm.
We have a brochure from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service that says we should look for non-lead options.
Mm-hmm.
So Aaron, in the state, it's not regulated that you have to use a non-lead option, so you still can use lead. I think it becomes a personal choice. I'll tell you from my personal experiences and having a young family that we feed venison to, we have gone to a non-toxic alternative. So we load my dad hand loads a non-toxic copper bullet. So that is out there. I mean, those components are available. They may cost a bit more at the onset, but I always kind of argue if you're going to load 50 rounds of deer ammunition and you only use maybe one or two a year, the cost is pretty negligible. The difference is pretty negligible over time. So there's also concern for contamination, especially with like bald eagles that feed on deer carcasses and can obtain lead poisoning through ingesting the lead fragments. So again, it's not regulated. I've again erred on the side of caution by using non-lead bullets ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there's. I was just going to mention, Aaron, there have been a number of studies, especially done out in the West with some of the bald eagles and.
And California condors.
The condors for sure. That they have demonstrated that there's lead ingestion as you have these scavengers eating the carcasses. So, you know, there are certainly carcasses that are shot and are not recovered. And so other animals feed on it, and it definitely can get into the food chain. So I would suggest, like Jamie, if you've got the option to use non-lead, it's not a bad thing to do.
And I don't load my own ammunition, so our local sporting shops, do they handle non-lead options?
The larger ones should start to, you know, you should be able to see some of those options on the store. It's been a long time since I've looked at ammunition myself, so
yeah, but there shouldn't be any with the major stores.
Yeah, they should carry a line of non-toxic.
And you just may want to call around non-lead. To save yourself a couple trips. You know, call a couple stores first and just ask before you start traveling around.
And Aaron, I'm sure you're well aware, but you would want to sight in if you're switching loads. You want to go back to the range and sight in that firearm again.
All right.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. We're talking a bit about the deer herd right now, but we're taking other wildlife questions as well. So give a call at 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. You know, the temperatures have dropped, and our homes are proving tempting for some wildlife, mice and other things. What do you do about keeping wildlife out of the
home? Now's the perfect time to start an annual maintenance regime where you're prepping your yard or your home. Last month we talked about preparing your yard or not doing anything with your yard to prepare for having wildlife. Now we want to talk about what can you do to keep your home pest-free this winter. And some of that is really walking around the outer structure of your home and looking for places, small little crevices, nooks and crannies where mice or squirrels or other small animals can get in. So looking for holes and cracks, and then either sometimes you can use a caulk or expandable foam to fill in those cracks. Sometimes you might find a section of rotten wood that makes it prone to an insect infestation, which then may attract a wildlife species. You might actually need to remove a whole section and repair that whole section. So that would be one example. Certainly the flanges on the bottom of your doors, making sure your window screens are intact. There's no tears or openings. That would be another key one. And then another, and I know David's had calls, we frequently get calls about folks who have raccoons in their chimneys. So raccoons or chimneys and fireplaces certainly keep us warm. They're great places for wildlife to come and find shelter as well. So if you don't have a chimney cap on your chimney,
you better be checking your chimney.
It is time to do it. That investment of $40, $50, it's just inevitable. It might not be this winter, but at some point you're going to have some animal down that chimney. So invest that money up front. The Benjamin Franklin quote of an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. Removing a raccoon from the chimney, if you're hiring somebody to come and do it, you're looking at over $100 probably to contain
versus a $25 chimney cap. So.
So that would be another big prevention.
I was thinking about prevention. I drove from Madison to Appleton over the weekend, and the number of dead deer on the roadside that had been hit by cars.
It's increasing.
Yeah.
As was really, there were a lot of deer between Madison and Appleton that were dead. And boy, it's time to be paying careful attention.
October and November are the highest vehicle collision, you know, months for vehicle, deer vehicle collisions. And it's those males that are rutting right now and really either chasing does, pushing them to run from cover. But now's the time, both dawn and dusk, but throughout the day, to really be aware on the road. So, and if you see one deer, slow down because there's likely more following.
Yeah, I was just sharing this statistic with a class I was teaching the other day, and across the country, near deer vehicle collisions, they amount to about $5.3 billion a year. So it's a billion with a B as in Bravo, $5.3 billion a year in damage, and that's annual damage. I mean, that is the small GDP of some small countries, you know, so that's a lot of money.
Yeah.
That just is an indication of how many deer and how frequent it is that deer and vehicles are colliding.
Auto insurance companies would like to eliminate that to zero.
Yes. Yep. Yep. Absolutely.
And if you hit a deer, you're not happy.
No.
Yeah. For sure. Well, Phil in Black River Falls has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Phil.
Hello.
Hi, what's on your mind today?
Well, I'm heading north to northern Minnesota. Just listened to your wolf conversation. And also, we're going up for deer hunting, which begins Saturday. And I'm listening to your program, and we have observed a black bear on our webcam. And so my question is, what concern might we have as we approach our blinds in the 4:30 a.m. time period? In regards to black bear, I mean wolves. I'm not too concerned about wolves because they take off, but the black bears have been known to kind of hang around.
Yeah. Well, Phil, that's a good question. One thing this time of the year, you know, a lot of bears are starting to go into hibernation. So the number of bears you've seen on the camera, I'm not sure how recently you saw them on the camera, but the number of bears you saw on the camera, you know, in the past compared to now, is probably going to be reduced simply because they are starting to go into hibernation. So that's one thing. You know, if you're baiting in that area, it could be bringing bears in to that area. So make sure that you're...
We're not baiting.
Okay, so you don't have to worry about that so much, you know. And the other thing is, you know, bears have, just like wolves, you know, they know that you're there a lot sooner than you realize that they're there. And the bears, with their great sense of smell and hearing and things like that, that... you know, they're probably not in any great interest to encounter you any more than you are to encounter them. So most likely they're going to take off long before you're even aware that they're around. And in the event that you do encounter a bear, just stand your ground, make yourself look large. You know, certainly you've got a firearm with you, so if you need to, you can shoot off a firearm. But make noise to try to scare the bear out of that area. And generally that should do it. Especially nowadays, you know, they don't have the risk with the cubs is not as great as it is earlier in the year, and so they're not going to be as protective or defensive as those cubs. So I think, you know, it's probably highly unlikely you're going to encounter a bear this time of year. But if you do, just stand your ground, make yourself as large as possible, shoot off a shot across the head if you need to, not at the bear, but just to scare it off up into the air, shoot it up in the air, and then just go about your business.
Yeah, there you go. Good luck with your hunt, Phil.
All right, thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Taking a look at the world of wildlife here in Wisconsin today with our two guests, David Drake and Jamie Knack from UW Extension and from the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. I'm Larry Mueller, Michelle Johnson, our on-air producer today here on the Ideas Network. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Coming up after 3 on Central Time today, we'll be talking about the investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 election. We get the latest on this and some other top national stories of the week from a Washington reporter. We'll also hear about a program getting Wisconsin veterans involved in farming. That after 3 today on Central Time. Right now, taking a look at the world of wildlife with our guests, David Drake and Jamie Knack. And let's turn back to the phones. You can join in. I think there's an open line at 800-642-1234. But John in Green Bay has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, John.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
This may be usual or unusual, but I have a family of gray fox that live on my property here, and the two young ones, pups or kids, whatever they're called, are eating my bird seed. You know, every night they're out here, and you know the bird seed that has come off the feeder itself, and they might be out here for half an hour or longer eating the hulls of the sunflower seeds. Is that usual or unusual? Or?
Yeah.
Well, I think it's highly exciting.
Yeah,
unusual, though.
Yeah, it's pretty unusual. So we have two species of fox in the state, the red fox and the gray fox. The red fox will have a reddish, more reddish color.
I've got a red fox shows up once in a while, but the gray fox are here almost every night.
And I was just going to say, the gray fox are a little bit more elusive than the red fox, so that's an even rarer occurrence to be seen. Something that's pretty interesting between the two species is that the gray fox can actually climb trees. They have semi-retractable claws, and they can climb. So they have kind of a cat-like adaptation, even though they're a member of the canid family. There's a couple reasons they might be. They're obviously eating your bird seed because you're seeing them do it, but also there are small mammals in that area likely eating your bird seed that might be an overall attractant, whether it be to the adult, and the adult is bringing them there, and it's looking for that mammalian prey. Or
I just wish they'd eat the squirrels. That's what I'm
saying. I'm sure they're eating the squirrels, too. You just may not see them.
Yeah, so they're kind of checking out your yard because you have that food source that's bringing in other wildlife, and they're seeing it as a possible source of prey. So if that's concerning to you, you can either use a different style feeder. I thought maybe your question would be that they were actually accessing the feeder because they can climb, but there would be different ways to keep them from getting to that.
No, I don't mind that at all. I mean, I have the skunks eat there at the bird feeder. The raccoons eat all this on the ground. No, it's clean as can be. I don't know where all the seed is coming from, frankly.
I have a suspicion that they're hanging out because there's other smaller mammals hanging out there, and they're taking advantage of them.
Okay. Yeah, there you go. Thanks, John. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, that's pretty neat.
You better get your camera out and get some photos. Have you had some photos?
I have not taken photos, no.
You should take some photos and post them up on our Facebook page. I'd love
that
to see that.
That would
really be cool. Thank you very much for calling. Well, Madeline and DePere, what's on your mind?
Well, I listened to the On Point show, and most of the callers who called in were men concerned about animals.
Yeah.
My question comes from the perspective of a potential future great-grandmother. Has a wolf ever been a case where a wolf has attacked a small child? Ever recorded a case like that?
So Madeline, that's a good question, and you're probably not the only one with a concern about be it wolf or other wildlife attacking human beings. I'm not aware, and I probably can't point right now to a case of a wolf attacking a child. I'm sure it probably has occurred at some point in past history because wolves and humans interact, and there have been cases where wolves have attacked and killed adults that I'm aware of, things like that. It is extremely rare that something like that would happen. I mean, I don't know what the statistic is, but I'm guessing you've got a better chance of getting struck by lightning than something like that happening to you or one of your great-grandchildren. So please don't be too overly concerned about it. With that being said, if you do live in areas where perhaps your house is in the midst of a wolf pack or something like that, and if you're not sure about where the wolf packs are situated in the state of Wisconsin, you can go to the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources website and just type in wolf or, you know, gray wolf, timber wolf, whatever you want. And there's some wonderful maps there that show you the current status of the wolf packs in the state of Wisconsin. And you can figure out where you are relative to that. If you are in the area where there are wolves, you just want to be due diligent and make sure that if the child is out and wolves are in that area, that the child's not out alone, that there's an adult out there. You have some kind of a plan in place. If you see wolves, you do want to scare them out of the area, so you want to try to haze or harass them so they leave the area. You put a fear of humans in them, but you also want to make sure that child is not by themselves as well. Make sure that you don't have anything in your yard that's attracting the wolf in there, so you're not feeding pets outside. There's not if you're on a farm or something like that, that if you have cows that are dead on the farm, that you clean those carcasses up and remove them off the landscape as fast as you possibly can, you know, things like that. So just be smart about it. But again, I don't want to cause undue concern or anxiety or fear for you or anybody else listening. That the risk of a wolf attack on a child is very, very rare. And again, if you just make sure you're diligent and careful if you are in the area where wolves are.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you, Madeline. Appreciate your call. You can join in too, 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. I want to go back to regulations for a minute before we take some more calls. I know there are some regulations. There's one regarding ground blinds. Is there not, Jamie?
There is. So there's a few changes here. So north of Highway 64, so the northern part of the state, you can now have ground blinds and tree stands left overnight on DNR-managed land. There are some additional requirements and regulations with this. Those can be found on page 34 of the hunting regulations. Some of them include things like if you're going to leave that ground blind or tree stand, walk away from it, you need to have a customer ID number or your name and address. You also need to have 144 square inches of solid blaze visible in all directions. And you cannot have more than two portable devices per hunter per county. So again, that's north of 64, new opportunity to leave a ground blind and tree stands left out overnight on DNR managed lands.
What's the information on the phones and so forth? You said there was, what was that second part that you mentioned?
The regulation?
Yeah,
on
in
what
the
page?
What's it about? Why can you only have two?
So it would be about the intent there would be not to have somebody be able to lay claim or stake a number of areas within a given
county. Mobile device, not a phone, but mobile device as in
portable,
a stand or portable.
Portable.
When you said mobile device, I thought
phone,
and I thought, why would you?
Leave.
Yep. So whether you have a tree stand or, and again, these have to be portable or mobile. They can't be built on public land. So you can only have two per county, and the reason would be to just allow room for other hunters.
Yeah, that makes
good sense.
Not
lay claim to a bunch of areas.
All right, on to
And then just south of 64, your blinds and tree stands on DNR-managed lands need to be removed at the close of shooting hours each day.
Okay.
So south of 64, you need to remove those items.
Let's go back to Dick and to the phones and to Dick in Cumberland. Hi, Dick.
Hi, good morning. Say, I was listening to your program with quite a bit of interest, especially with the gentleman who had the bird feeder in. He was attracting fox and other animals, et cetera, beneath that cleaning up a seed. I think we're kind of missing an important point I wanted to bring along. For many years, they used to run a rabies vaccine and rabies immunoglobulin distribution center out of Cumberland Hospital, being the director of pharmacy for many years when the supply was short. And the thing to remember is that these other animals, raccoons and fox and skunk, et cetera, can be a vector for spreading the rabies vaccine, rabies virus. So I'm kind of curious about whether or not how much of that viral load they could impact by leaving that on grass and on poles and other types of ground objects down there while they're all gathering around there and possibly spreading it. And I know that the vaccine and rabies immunoglobulin are extremely expensive to administer, and it can present a huge cost to a lot of people that might not have appropriate insurance.
Yeah, Dick, that's a very good concern to raise. From a rabies standpoint, I will say that my guess is it's a relatively minor risk, even if you have a rabid animal and if they're at the feeder feeding, you know, leaving some kind of a body fluid around. I would suspect there's probably a minor risk. And, you know, the two most common carriers of rabies in the wildlife world in Wisconsin are either bats or striped skunks, and usually it's only about 1-2% of the population of those species have rabies at any given time. So it is very, very rare. I think the more relevant issue is, you know, feeders are, we talk a lot about not baiting deer and things like that because you're concentrating artificially high numbers of animals at a concentrated location. That's essentially what we're doing with bird feeding, but bird feeding, we look at it a little bit differently. But with feeders, you know, especially with house finches, you can see eye conjunctivitis in the wintertime. And there are other issues where possibly you can spread disease because you are concentrating artificially dense number of animals in one location. So you just want to be careful about that, especially with the bird feeders. You know, clean your feeders regularly in a bleach water mixture or water soapy water mixture, something like that, regularly. Make sure if your feed's getting wet that you clean that wet feed out, put dry feed in, use high quality feed and things like that. And if you can spread your feeders out a little bit, that also will be helpful. So you are correct that you just want to be careful about vectors of disease, but I think generally if you are prudent about how you feed birds in particular, that you should be pretty safe.
Yeah, there we go. Thank you very much for calling, Dick. John in Waniwak, sorry. John, your turn.
Hi. I'm glad you took my call. Thank you very much. Can you hear me?
Yes, yeah, go right ahead.
Okay. When you were talking earlier about confronting a black bear, one of you made the comment about firing a shot off into the air. I'm a retired attorney, and I know that that has resulted in negligent homicide cases being brought against the person who discharged the firearm into the air or onto a body of water. And I just wanted to people to understand that a cartridge, especially out of a high-powered rifle, can travel for many miles and is lethal for many miles.
That's a very good point. Jamie?
Yeah, so John, that is certainly a good point. I just also want to kind of counter that a little bit too, in that, you know, when we hunt and we have maybe 500,000 to 600,000 licensed deer hunters in the woods that will harvest, maybe during the 9-deer gun season, 200,000 deer. That is a responsibility that every hunter has as well, is to know what lies beyond the target. So I want to take this opportunity to reiterate the four rules of firearm safety, but know that this would apply in the case that David was referring to with somebody encountering a bear or a threat. And if they would feel the need for their safety to fire a shot, that would be done so in a manner as they would when they were hunting with these four rules in mind. And so that is known as the acronym for that we use in hunter safety here in the state is TAB-K, the T being treat every gun as if it is loaded. A is always point the muzzle in a safe direction. B, be sure of your target and what lies beyond. And K, keep your finger off the trigger until you're ready to shoot. So again, in these cases, we need to be very aware of what lies beyond that target. So if we're discharging the firearm, we may do it at the ground would be a safe, maybe perhaps a safer way. But we shoot waterfowl, with shotguns that don't travel as far as rifles. But, you know, we need to be aware of where that cartridge or pellet and so on is falling.
It's falling, yep. You bet. John, good reminder. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. I was remembering when daughter Emily went through the hunter safety. Mm-hmm. That was the one thing that was an automatic failure was if your finger on the trigger, you were done.
Yep.
You failed.
My girls just received BB guns the past few Christmases, and I wouldn't let them touch them until they could recite the TAB-K rules. Mm-hmm. So
there you go. Let's go to Tom in Madison next. Hi, Tom.
Hey, how you doing?
Great. Appreciate the call. What can we do for you?
Well, I got bats in my belfry. And, I've been struggling on finding out where they come in, and I finally figured out where they're coming in, and I can block that. The question I have is, do they actually, this time of year, still go out and about seeking food that I can, block them out once they're outside the house?
Yeah, Tom, that's a good question. We are getting to that point where it's getting a little bit late for them to start seeking food. Now, if we get another warm spell, for example, before we go into the cold, long, dark winter for the next 3 years, they might come out, to feed for a little bit. But they're really starting to settle in for hibernation right now. And again, just as a reminder, we've got a number of species of bats that are what we call resident species. So they do not migrate out of our state during the wintertime, and instead they'll hibernate over winter in caves, mines, attics like yours, things like that. It's those state resident species that are hibernating that are also susceptible to white nose syndrome, and those are the species that are starting to decline in numbers simply because that disease is killing them at a faster rate than they can reproduce, or that's what we think at least. So I would encourage you, if you're willing and you can tolerate it, to maybe let the bats stay where they are for the winter, and then next spring when it starts getting warm again and they start getting to be active, and they'll leave your house. Be prepared at that time to kind of wall them out. So once they leave, they can't get back in ever again. And early in the spring, you are allowed legally to exclude bats from your house. After about May 15th, you cannot do that until the end of July. But if you go to we have a website, wildlifedamage.uwex.edu. If you go to that website, you can download for free a publication on bat management, and it talks about how to exclude bats from buildings, houses, things like that. I'd encourage you to take a look at that. It is relatively easy. You can use a one-way bat excluder if you want to. You can make it yourself. You can buy it commercially, but that's probably the best thing to do. But I would encourage you to leave them in the attic if you can for the winter. And the dates I mentioned is May 15th. It's actually, June 1st to August 15th is when you cannot legally exclude bats from buildings simply because they may have young in there. And once you exclude the mom, she can't get back in to take care of the young.
And what's the website again that you gave?
It's Wildlife Damage. So all one word, .uwex.edu. So D is in Delta.
Okay. There we go. Thank you. Thank you so much, Tom, for calling. And while we're at it, there was, I saw some recent research that's going on, or that will be going on, regarding white nose syndrome with ultraviolet lights or something. Are you familiar with that, David?
Yeah, I know they're trying to do a bunch of, taking a bunch of different attempts at trying to kill the fungus that causes white nose syndrome. And, they were looking at some soil bacterium for a little while. They're trying ultraviolet lights and things like that. To my knowledge, nothing's been demonstrated to be effective yet, or if it's effective, it's effective on perhaps individual bats, but it's not effective yet across the entire cave ecosystem where they're hibernating. And that cave ecosystem is pretty delicate and fragile. And so the concern is, once you start getting in there and you start killing one thing, how does it affect everything else as a domino effect in that ecosystem, and may you do more damage than you intend to do. So I know they're starting to look at ultraviolet lights and things like Clorox and stuff like that, but to my knowledge, nothing has been demonstrated to be effective across the entire, hibernaculum.
Yeah, I think there's some Wisconsin bats that are going to be sent to Cornell University for testing with ultraviolet light to see. So that's... Yep. I mean, it's, something that's in the works.
It is.
A lot of that research is happening right here in Madison at the National Wildlife Health Lab.
Yep, I was just going to mention that over at the United States Geological Survey Wildlife Health Lab off of Schrader Road here in South Madison. Yeah.
David Drake and Jamie Knack, our guests today, as we take a look at the world of wildlife. You can join in. The number to call, we'll get you on pretty quickly, at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. Taking a look at the world of wildlife today with David Drake and Jamie Knack, both from the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW. They're also with UW Extension. Always great to have them come by. You can join us again, 800-642-1234. Let's go to Jim in Heartland next. Jim, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. How are you?
Great. Appreciate your call.
I read an interesting article about a little less than a year ago on the Wisconsin Eastern Elk, or the American Eastern Elk, which is now extinct. And supposedly Teddy Roosevelt, back in the early 1900s when he was president, sent the government of New Zealand a gift, and the gift was a couple herds of these eastern elk. And the article went on to say that they were trying to find out through DNA testing if this was the original eastern elk species, which is now, thought to be extinct.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if you guys know anything of that.
Yeah.
And, if you do, is there any chance to reintroduce that elk here?
Okay. Yeah. David, we'll start with you, and Jamie, join
well,
in, too.
Jim, I don't know much about that, unfortunately. I will encourage you to maybe to go to the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation website. They probably have some pretty good information on the eastern elk there. There are a number of different elk species and subspecies in the state, and not just in the state of Wisconsin, but across the country. And obviously, they are reintroducing elk, which was a historically native species in Wisconsin. They are reintroducing elk and trying to reestablish elk populations in Wisconsin, the first being up at Clam Lake, and then most recently in the Black River Falls area there. So I'm not sure about the eastern elk as well. It would not surprise me, the story about sending elk to New Zealand. You know, Teddy Roosevelt certainly was a very strong proponent for conservation and was one of the first, you know, famous conservationists in this country, and did a lot for conservation. And it's not unusual, for example, you know, we're taking elk from Kentucky to reintroduce here in Wisconsin, and when that happens, we will send a species of animal down to that state, and a lot of times it might be turkey, or it could be rough grouse, or, you know, we've sent a lot of bald eagles to other states to recolonize the eagle populations in states. So wildlife exchange across state boundaries or even across country boundaries is not unusual, but I'm not familiar with the story you're talking about. And I'll maybe
Jamie, do you have
anything? Jamie has anything?
I don't have any more to add to that other than to reiterate, go to the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation website. They have information on all the subspecies, and I would guess we'll have a link to some of that research going on, or biologists that you could call and ask that question, but they would be well informed on that.
It's interesting, though. Thanks, mm-hmm. Jim.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, appreciate it. Bob in Ashland County, your turn now. Hi, Bob.
I had a question on deer registration.
Yeah.
If you were to harvest a deer, a buck, and register that deer immediately with your cell phone, could you proceed to cut that deer up to pack it out easier? Would that be legal?
Oh, that's an interesting question.
I don't see why not, but I think it would be good to just double check. But I think that is one of the advantages of having that mobile registration. I guess I would just caution you to just call the DNR customer number and just ask that to be absolutely certain.
Yeah.
But once that deer is registered,
that's it.
That's it.
Yeah. Or if you're familiar with the conservation warden in your area, mm-hmm. that'd be another good contact or resource.
Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. I was thinking about that. If you're in northern Wisconsin, you're there for the week, and it turns out to be a warm time period. Yeah. You want to get those
hides off,
and the deer process. That's probably not a bad strategy for sure. Well, have other callers online again. You can join us, 800-642-1234. Give a call. We have another caller online. I'm not sure if we can get to him yet or not. Yeah, Ken in Merrill. Let's go to you. Hi, Ken.
Hello. Just a couple of questions. I believe I've got a couple of black coyotes on my property. I hear they're pretty rare. One question, they haven't been a problem, really, but if they were ever to become a problem, could I actually shoot them without any type of license?
Okay.
Yeah, so Ken, up where you are, you know, coyotes do come in different coat colors. But one thing I would be concerned about is it is also common to have black wolves. And you're in wolf country, so I would make double certain, triple certain that that's a wolf and not a coyote, because a coyote, not a wolf, but because wolves are in the endangered species list right now and are not legal to be harvested, whether you're intending to do it or not. So I would just double check that. And there's you know, some things, differences in wolves, coyotes. It can be easy to confuse them, especially at a distance. But typically, wolves are, you know, can be upwards of twice the size or a little bit more than a coyote. Wolves, the ears are shorter and rounded relative to a coyote, but that's all relative. If you're looking at one animal, you don't have comparison. Coyotes, the snout is typically longer and more narrow. The wolf snout is typically shorter and a little bit wider, things like that. So I would be really careful before you shoot anything up there and make sure that it's not a wolf. If it is a coyote, however, even if it is a black one, There's an open season on coyotes in the state of Wisconsin. So on property you own, if coyotes are causing problems, you can kill them at any time you want to, any time of the year, on your own property. So you would be legal to do so in a nuisance situation.
Right. What about in the stomach? Now, these, the ones I saw, there's actually a pair of them. The ears were quite long and more rounded on the top. I had an opportunity to look it up, you know, online, and a side-by-side comparison. I'm quite sure they are coyotes, but the ears seemed extremely long and not pointed at all on top or rounded. And the stomach was real sallow, I guess you'd call it, almost like a race dog, you know, like a greyhound. So I don't
Well,
know.
Well, yeah, I wouldn't. I guess I would just to err on the side of caution before you do anything. I would try to get a very, very good picture of these animals with a camera, and examine that a little bit. And if you have any questions at all, or put a game camera out or something like that. If you have any questions at all, you know, go to the DNR up there in the north. They're familiar with what wolves look like relative to coyotes. You might want to look again on the DNR website, as we've referenced earlier today, and look at where the nearest wolf pack is relative to where you're located, things like that. I'm not saying you shouldn't shoot a coyote if it's causing a problem. You certainly would be legal to do that on your own property. But I would hate for you to mistake a wolf for a coyote and accidentally shoot a wolf, because it's not good for the political situation right now, and it is going to get you into a heap of trouble.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. You know, I've heard that some snowy owls have made their appearance back in Wisconsin.
Boy, with
Jamie.
With these cold temperatures and the north winds, we've had some more birds coming in from Canada and other places. But there, in the most recent bird report I saw, there has been two reports of snowy owls in northern Wisconsin, as well as both red and white crossbills. Red poles.
Yeah, that's pretty neat.
I'm trying to think what else. Yeah. Certainly seen a big push from the waterfall front for migration. So now would be an excellent, excellent time to get to Horicon National Wildlife Refuge or Crex. There's apparently over 5,000 cranes at Crex right now.
Wow.
And the Canada geese are continuing to build at Horicon, in addition to trumpeter swans and lots of different species of ducks. So it's a really nice time to be out. And if you're in the southern part of the state, you still have some color out there with the foliage. So it's been kind of a late.
Yeah, it's been kind of strange that way. I mean, because there's still plenty of color in the southern, Madison area, for example.
I'm surprised we have that much color, because we were pretty dry going into the fall, and usually that does not promote really good fall colors on the trees. So it's nice to see it.
Yeah, it really is. Again, you can join us. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. That whole migration thing is so... Where are we in migration in terms of our birds?
We're pretty late into migration. I mean, the birds that are sticking around are what we would consider the late migrants, so sandhill cranes, waterfowl, things like that, or some of the later birds. You know, a lot of the warblers have left, hummingbirds have left, some of the, more what we'd call the neotropical, the songbirds have all cleared out and are going. And typically, with the migration, what drives this, what is the primary driver of this, is time of daylight, the amount of daylight you have. And as that day length shortens, then you start getting cooler temperatures and changing wind directions and things like that. And that starts telling these birds that are migrating, hey, it's time to get going out of here. But, they've got only so much energy to get from point A up north to point B where they're going to winter over. And so they also have to be smart about how they do this. And typically, unless the wind's blowing out of a northerly direction, they're not moving, because they're not going to fly into a headwind and waste a bunch of energy.
Yeah.
So, that's the other thing about feeders, is one thing just to maybe think about is take your feeders down for a little bit, because you can artificially hold birds in areas where if there's food available, they'll stick around and not always to their benefit. So maybe take your feeders down for a little bit and then put them back up later this month.
Tim in Appleton, your turn. Hi, Tim.
Hi. weird things happened to me this fall. This is about a month ago. In the course of 3 days, I saw three different gray squirrels carrying another adult gray squirrel that was dead. And I'm wondering how, I've never seen, I'm 48 years old, I've never seen that before.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, and for sure it was dead, Tim?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
I'm just wondering what's lacking in their diet this year.
Yeah.
That cannibalism is taking over.
I don't know exactly what that is. You know, I guess it's not terribly uncommon that some animals will eat their own, so to speak, especially for food like that. But the reason I was asking, are you sure it's dead? Because squirrels will breed multiple times over the course of a year, and they will move the young from nest to nest. Or squirrel nests are called drays, from dray to dray. And the way they do that is they hold them in their mouth. If you know... It's unusual for an adult squirrel to be carrying another squirrel that's roughly the same size, because that's a lot of work, especially, and it's unlikely they'd be moving an adult squirrel from dray to dray. So, you know, who knows why they're moving it? Maybe they're moving it, you know, for food. Maybe they're trying to get it out of an area if they've got young there, and they're trying not to bring have predators coming in. So I'm not exactly sure.
Well, we'll talk some more about that and take your wildlife questions right after we take a look at the news and weather and find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network with our guests, David Drake and Jamie Neck. Stay with us. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network, taking a look at the world of wildlife today with David Drake and Jamie Neck from the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison, and also they're with UW Extension. So great to have them with us. I'm Larry Mueller, by the way. And lots of callers online, so we'll go back to the phones and to Jim in Larson. Hi, Jim.
Good afternoon. I wonder if people are experiencing the same sort of thing with grouse hunting that I am. I've been pretty serious about it in far northern Wisconsin, and relative to the drumming counts that were up in the spring, I'm seeing extremely few birds, to the point where I would have to say that this could be one of the very worst grouse hunting seasons in terms of seeing birds that I've ever experienced. I've heard a hypothesis that perhaps the prolonged spring rains during the summer really eliminated a lot of the clutches, and I'm just wondering whether or not my experience is common with other things that are being heard from around the state.
All right. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, Jim, the drumming counts and the brood counts were slightly up this year over past years. So I believe that the population was thought to be still a little bit on the rise. But it is true that if we have wet, cold weather, well, the chicks are hatching out and the broods are not quite able to support themselves. That certainly can have quite a bit of mortality. I've had a few conversations last week with a couple people who were out grouse hunting, and they kind of reported the same thing you did. They didn't see a lot of grouse. They had a wonderful time out there, but they didn't see a lot of grouse, nor did they harvest a lot of grouse. So I guess just, you know, from my sample size of you and two others, I've heard the same thing. But I'm not sure if that's a statewide issue or if that's just a local issue where you and these other two hunters have been.
Yeah.
And we have the monitoring in place, so it'll be interesting to see what the spring drumming counts, drumming surveys look like this coming spring.
Yeah. But something to look for.
We will, yeah, the state will have the information to make that inference.
Yeah. Thanks for calling. Appreciate it. Eileen in Waterford, it's your turn. Hi, Eileen.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I live on a rural farmhouse in the town of Waterford, and I'm surrounded by walnut trees and a few silver maples. And I'm only here part of the year, but I've always had a ton of squirrels, and I mean a ton of squirrels. This year I have none. Not one gray squirrel have I seen in the almost month I've been here.
Yeah.
And it is, I called the wildlife department, and they said they didn't have any idea what it could have been. They said there was an uptick in West Nile virus this year, and that they were susceptible to that. But to decimate the entire population, I think there must be something else. So didn't know if anybody else was having that same observation.
Right.
So I don't really have anything to add to that, Eileen. I've not had anybody else really mention or talk about.
No.
I'm seeing squirrels, but this is a similar you know, call that we get quite often, whether it be blue jays or, you know, whatever the species that, oh, I'm not seeing many this year. And so it may be your local population, like very local population of squirrels has had a decline, or they've moved elsewhere, or maybe did not have a successful nesting attempt this year. Mm-hmm. That there's some real local factors that are that are the reasons why you're not seeing squirrels right in your yard. But
overall numbers are pretty high.
Yeah.
Yeah. There we go. Thanks for calling, Eileen. Tom in Wisconsin Dells, your turn now. Hi, Tom.
Well, hi.
What can we do for you?
Well, I drive from Minneapolis to Chicago a few times a year on I-94, and this last time I probably counted 8 or 10 dead deer along the road.
Yep.
And sometimes it's even worse, but this time of year, I suppose. Anyway, this is a little far out, probably, but is there anybody concerned about, any organizations concerned about roadkill? And if they are, I'd like to support them.
Yeah.
Tom, that's a good question. I am not aware of anybody who systematically monitors the number of deer vehicle collisions in the state, the county, other states, things like that. There are plenty of estimates out there, and indexes and things like that.
Insurance companies can give you a pretty good
idea. Insurance companies can. Usually if you call the county or state Department of Transportation, a lot of times they've got some idea about it because they have to contract with people to either pick up the carcasses or they do it themselves, depending on the municipality or the county or where in the state it is. So I'm not sure if the deer strikes are up or not, but again, as Jamie was mentioning earlier in the show, this is the time when we start seeing the peak of deer vehicle collisions. So it is more common that you'd see the deer on the side of the road killed now than other times of the year. And you certainly, because it's just the number of deer, you're more aware of it, without a doubt. But in terms of what you can do to prevent deer vehicle collisions, you know, just again, as Jamie was mentioning, during those sun up, sun down hours, that's the crepuscular period of the day. That's when deer are moving quite a bit. So as the sun is coming up in the morning, going down in the evening, just make sure that you're uber cautious about driving. You're very aware. You're constantly scanning the horizon from side to side, especially when you get into areas where forested areas start meeting the roadway. Deer can dart out of there, and your field of vision to see the deer coming out of the forest is very limited. So you might want to slow your car down a little bit in those areas. Make sure you're very vigilant. You're constantly monitoring and watching. And especially where you see these deer crossing signs put up by the DOT, make sure that you are very cautious in those areas, because those seem to be the concentrated areas. Although in certain areas with deer populations increasing, it can be any place, even where you might not expect it. So just be careful right now. And by the end of this month, it should abate a bit, because the rut or that breeding period is going to start decreasing. Number of hunters out there will start decreasing the number of deer on the landscape and things like that. But for the next month or so, especially around sunup, sundown, just be careful when you're driving.
There'll probably be a couple hundred thousand fewer deer
after Thanksgiving.
After Thanksgiving. Thanks, Tom. Dot in Manitowoc, your turn. Hi, Dot.
Hi, good afternoon. My daughter and two granddaughters were running their mixed breed dog along a wild wooded park along a river. As I was waiting for them, what I decided was one coyote walking down the road. If they would have met, would there have been a fight? And I might add that the dog is very protective of my daughter. So would there have been a confrontation?
Yeah, Dot, thanks for the question. Most likely, no. And so what's happening, the coyote is probably is aware that your daughter and others are there, including the dog. The coyote is probably more curious of the dog than it is the human beings, because the dog is in the same family, the canine family, as the coyote. And the coyote is just wondering, hey, what are you doing in my territory or my area here? And just trying to check that out. in the vast, vast majority of times that people encounter coyotes with or without dogs, the coyote will typically go in the opposite direction after it sees what's going on with the person or the dog. If the coyote does not move away, then in all future encounters, anytime somebody encounters a coyote, they should try to scare or haze that coyote out of the area by yelling at it, waving your arms in big circular motions, throwing sticks or stones in the general direction of the animal. Don't hit the animal with a stick or stone. But you want that animal to move away from you. It may not necessarily run away from you, but you want it to move away from you. And if that animal is moving away from you, then that hazing technique is being effective. But typically, in that situation you described, that nothing negative or bad is going to occur to either the coyote, the dog, or the humans involved in that encounter.
Yeah. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, 800-642-1234, the number to call. I want to take some emails that have been piling up here. Are wildcats like, this is from Yvonne in Twin Lakes, wildcats like mountain lions moving east across the U.S. due to predation, perhaps? Any chance of them making it into Wisconsin? Well, we've had a few.
Yeah, we've had some documented reports of cougar or mountain lion, same species, in the state. That's coming from DNA evidence, either from scat or blood or hair, where we've confirmed that those cougars are young males that are expanding from the Black Hills population in South Dakota. And so it's not likely a prey driven. It's more probably density of the population in South Dakota. So these are young males that are kind of out on their own now, looking to establish their own territories, and they're able to explore and travel long distances. So they've come into Wisconsin, are looking for females, no females present at the time, you know, at this time, and so they continue to roam and move on. So we've had cougars documented, all young males, all being traced back to that Black Hills population.
The neatest story about that was a number of years ago. There was a mountain lion that came out of South Dakota, came through Minnesota into Wisconsin. And then the following June, that was in December one year, and the following June, it actually got hit by a car and killed about 30 miles west of the Atlantic Ocean in the state of Connecticut. And that was the longest single-distance movement ever recorded of a mountain lion. And that was a pretty interesting story.
Stella wants to remind us that people that test for chronic wasting disease with their deer, that the test is free. It doesn't cost you anything.
Yeah, thanks for the reminder on CWD, especially given the upcoming 9-day gun deer season and the opportunity to have your deer tested. And I think there's maybe some new urgency to test deer that are harvested during the hunt this year, as some preliminary results from a Canadian study have recently been reported. This study was conducted by the Canadian Food Inspection Agency. It's been published in abstract format. It still has to go through the peer review process. But their findings, that research over a three-year period, they had fed five monkeys a diet that included the equivalent of a single 7-ounce venison steak per month. So they were fed venison that had CWD. Three of the monkeys became infected, with two showing clinical signs of the disease. And, you know, their results, you know, what they're talking about right now is we really need additional research in terms of the risk of CWD to humans and to encourage hunters to get their disease tested. So it provides the state information in terms of surveillance and monitoring of chronic wasting disease, but also for your own well-being, getting your deer tested, especially if you're in one of the infected counties. And to do that, you can go to the DNR's website and do a search for registration stations. They have a database, so you can put in your county and it'll show you what stations are available for you to get that deer tested. You can also contact your local wildlife biologist and request to have that tested. And again, as she mentioned, no charge.
Matt emailed to ask, could either of you address the over-browsing of the understory in Wisconsin? In many areas, deer have exceeded the carrying capacity of the forest for decades. Little consideration given to the over-browse and its effect on the entire ecosystem. Botanical surveys have documented the lack of diversity directly contributed to white-tailed deer.
Yeah, Matt's absolutely correct to that observation that overabundance of deer has shifted and changed the vegetation component of forests and other vegetated areas, and has been going on for quite a while. It's not just in Wisconsin, but it's really across the eastern United States. And they have been implicated in the change from native vegetation to non-native vegetation, although there's a lot of other implications and causes of non-native vegetation in the state of Wisconsin as well, other places, things like that. Now in Wisconsin, for example, the Department of Natural Resources has moved to a County Deer Advisory Committee, or the CDAC system. And one of the things that the County Deer Advisory Committees do take into account is number of deer vehicle collisions, agricultural damage, landscape damage. And then they do look at now the habitat that is supporting deer. What does that habitat look like? Is it healthy? Is it overbrowsed? And all of that does feed into the recommendation from these County Deer Advisory Committees to either increase harvest, decrease harvest, or hold harvest steady. And so what Matt's talking about, it is trying to be accounted for, and they are trying to address the issue of overbrowsing, not only our native vegetation, but landscape and agricultural crops as well.
You look at some of the exclosures. I've seen some exclosures like in an alfalfa field.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Where deer can't get at it, and the alfalfa is twice as tall in those areas.
Yeah, it's
dramatic.
It's very dramatic. Bruce asks on Facebook, or says something, you stop at a gas station convenience store in rural areas, and you're likely to see bags of feed corn and apples by the pumps. The sign says deer corn for sale. Often in counties under deer baiting and feeding restrictions due to CWD. How are retailers and other folks able to do this, and why?
And the answer to that is because it is the actual bans for baiting and feeding do not apply to the selling of bait and feed, whether you're in an affected county or not, or whether your county is under that ban or not. So they can still legally sell it, but you may or may not be able to legally use it depending on the status of that county.
Christy emailed and found some parts of deer, legs and so forth, along the road, and wondered if the DNR has an education policy for hunters about disposing of, you know, the carcass that they're not, those parts they're not going to use. A good question.
Not so much a policy, but an ethics that every person who goes through a hunter education program is hopefully taught, and that etiquette is discussed. So proper disposal of your game or the carcass. Obviously, you have to harvest the meat off that animal, but the carcasses need to end up in a landfill or be buried on private property or so on. But what I would encourage is for you to report it, look around, see if you can find any evidence of a name. Sometimes there's other garbage, but wardens will often police state parking lots and see if they can't be able to find something identifiable to the person who might have left it and follow up on those. And yes, a citation can be issued.
I was going to say, if it's occurring in the same general spot on your property, you might want to put a game camera up in some kind of a stealth mode and see if you can't catch somebody on camera doing that.
Yeah.
And Leslie in Cottage Grove had a woodchuck kind of walking around in circles, walked right up to Leslie, and somebody from animal control said it was a circle disease. Are you familiar with that disease?
I think it's called whirling disease, if I'm not mistaken. Whirling?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think it's something, and then I don't know the details, but something infects the brain of the animal and it causes it to...
It's not rabies.
Well, listen, it's not rabies, but woodchucks, of all the rodent species, and woodchucks are a rodent, of all the rodent species, they're more susceptible to rabies than the other woodchuck or other rodent species are. I doubt that it's rabies, because there's some other signs with rabies about, you know, depending on whether it's foaming at the mouth, if it's real rabid rabies or not. But what I think it might be is tularemia. Is a rabbit fever, and you see this in rabbits a lot of times. It's a brain worm that's from flies, sometimes from ticks as well, and it causes rabbits to go in circles. They can't move in a straight line. They just go around and around and around in a circle because their brain is infected with this worm, and I'm wondering if it's not tularemia as well.
Yeah, could be. Well, Grayson in Wakefield, Michigan has a question. Let's go there. Grayson, hi.
Good morning. Thanks so much, or I guess it's noon, for taking the call. I appreciate that, and I appreciate the learning experience I always get on your show, sir.
Thank you.
I was for 7 years a pilot for the Department of Wildlife in Nevada, and so I got to meet people from all walks in that. And one of the, you know, the prime animals that they count is mule deer. And when we came to the, they have pretty defined routes when they crossed interstates. The law enforcement, local law enforcement, the state patrol, and the conservation officers made a concerted effort to enforce speeds. In fact, they also put up flashing yellow lights and with warnings that you could expect deer a lot more often. I know it's a different, whitetail has different migrations, probably a lot broader than the mule deer are pretty localized. But I heard that one fellow call and talk about all the deer he saw alongside the road. It always kills me when I see an animal that has died that way. I just thought I'd throw that out there as some of the...
Yeah, something that is done in other states.
Yeah, you know, they certainly have plenty of signage up across the state of Wisconsin as well as other states where they have concentrated deer crossings and not necessarily migration, because deer don't necessarily migrate as much as they would just move. So they do have signs up. They've got blinking lights, things like that. But, you know, that reminds me of that story where they were talking about this on the radio, and this woman calls in as one of the listeners to the radio show. She goes, well, why don't the deer cross where they're supposed to be crossing? You know, they put the crossing signs up for the deer, and she couldn't.
Well, and they wanted them to move the signs.
They wanted to remove the signs, right? So
they keep crossing there.
I heard that question. I think it was up on Facebook or something. Somebody had passed that along, and it was.
Yeah.
Oh, my.
The synapses just weren't connecting in that woman's head that day.
No, I don't think so. Well, here in our last minute, have you got some any last-minute advice in our last minute or so about the deer hunt?
Well, again, I would really encourage you. I still have homework to do myself before I feel comfortable setting foot out in the field. But you really do need to spend some time, set aside some time to review the regulations. The State Department of Natural Resources has done a nice job of putting together some fact sheets, commonly asked questions, information on the baiting and feeding, where to get your deer tested. It would always behoove you to do that research ahead of time so you know what your options are for getting it tested, making sure that you have your tag number with you, because if you're not going to carry your tag and you're just going to carry your authorized driver's license or your Go Wild card, you're still going to need that tag number when it comes time to register the animal. So there's some information you need to kind of gather and have with you.
And stay safe. So if you're using stands, make sure you strap in. Make sure all the things Jamie talked about, Tab K and things like that, just make sure you're safe, and everybody else out in the woods, make sure they're safe as well.
Well, David and Jamie, thank you both very much. We'll look forward to your next visit, probably the first Wednesday of next month.
Sounds good.
David Drake and Jamie Nack, our guests from the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at the UW-Madison. Jamie is an outreach specialist in the department, and they're both with University of Wisconsin Extension as well. So always fun to have them with us, and they will be back. Taking a look ahead, we'll welcome back our regulars from the Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection to talk about consumer protection issues. In the meantime, stay with us. Lots in store.